The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Desperate to stop Judge Kavanaugh's almost certain Supreme Court confirmation, the Democrats stoop to uncover an accusatory letter they've been sitting on since July.
They hid this from the chair of the committee.
Despite the poisonous political assault, Judiciary Committee Chair Charles Grassley remains composed and civil.
Accusations like this deserve consideration and looking into. And that's what the purpose of the hearing is.
We'll hear from someone who's been there, the likely next senator for the state of Arizona, Congresswoman Martha McSally.
Having been through this, but I will tell you, dirtbags are usually patterned dirtbags.
And out west, but spreading quickly across the country, homelessness seems unstoppable. Michael Medved is a front row observer.
What if the homeless person puts his tent on public property in the local park where you like to take your children to use the playground?
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. On July 10th, Judge Brett Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals was announced as the president's nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. It has been a torturous path for him over these past 2.5 months. Not an hour following his nomination, but there was unleashed an unremitting attack from the media's left and House Democrats. Democratic lawmaker used an abundance of creative chaos. During public committee hearings, Senate Judiciary Committees continuously and rudely interrupted, joining a chorus of spectator outbursts. A determined Republican chairman, Charles Grassley, was deliberate and resolute, guiding the hearing through to completion. This past week was to be a break following the hearing and a committee vote next week. Over the past weekend, Senator Feinstein, ranking Democrat on Judiciary, made public to the press a letter that had been in her possession since early July. The letter was authored by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, now a California college professor. Blasey Ford accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault that allegedly happened during a party while they were both in high school. Here's Senator Grassley on my show before it was known whether Dr. Ford would be willing to appear as a witness. Will the hearing on Monday be televised?
Yeah.
And will there only be two witnesses on Monday?
Yes.
Who's going to go first?
We haven't made up our mind on that yet, but I assume that Dr. Ford would.
Has Dr. Ford accepted and she has agreed to come?
No. We have reached out to her in the last 36 hours three or four times by email, and we've not heard from them. So it kind of raises the question, do they want to come to the public hearing or not? Accusations like this deserve consideration and looking into, and that's what the purpose of the hearing is. And we wouldn't be having this hearing if it wasn't for the fact that Dr. Ford told the Washington Post and other people publicly that she wanted to testify. And we also had Judge Kavanaugh, even before we requested him to testify, he said he was willing to testify. So we still haven't heard from Dr. Ford. So do they want to have the hearing or not? We're delaying the vote strictly to get all the facts out on the table.
Following my conversation with Senator Grassley, my colleague Mike Gallagher went to our mutual colleague Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. At that point, it was not known whether Ford would appear.
What happens if there's a showdown and only the accused appears?
Well, actually, I think what happens at that stage, if Grassley's smart, is he just closes the hearing out and says, look, we did this in order to give Dr. Ford an opportunity to publicly tell her story. If she's not going to show up, there's no point to this. Let's just go directly to a vote on the nomination, which will come back 11-10. But at least he will have given her the opportunity to do that. And if she doesn't take that opportunity up, then I think that that also reflects on the credibility of the accusation. And that's the way I think Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, I think that's what they're looking for. And Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins as well.
Now, you're a smart guy. I'm having a very difficult time getting past one key. I mean, there's so many ifs. There's so much we don't know. And, you know, regrettably, you don't know what happened 35 years ago. And this is what makes it such a frustrating development in this confirmation process. What we do know, evidently, is that Dianne Feinstein knew about this accusation back in July. So she's got a perfect opportunity. You've got testimony under oath, public, the whole world is watching. That's, of course, the time that you ask Judge Kavanaugh about this allegation. So can you help me understand why Dianne Feinstein realistically waits a few days before the scheduled vote before this gets out?
Well, I think what happened was that she was sitting on it. The charitable takeaway on this would be that Dianne Feinstein saw that there was just really no way of going forward with this thing because there's no corroboration, there's no evidence, and no witnesses to it. And decided not to use it. And it was the other Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee that leaked it and forced Feinstein's hand. Now, that's a possibility. But here's the problem I have with even that. That type of allegation should have been shared with the chair of the committee.
Immediately.
I mean, that is the proper protocol. Immediately shared with the chair of the committee and wasn't at all. They hid it from the Republicans until other Democrats forced it out into the open by leaking it out that she had something, you know, she had some sort of bombshell on Kavanaugh that had something to do with sexual assault.
Or perhaps they held it. I'll be more cynical than you are, and you're a generous guy. They waited till the 11th hour because, frankly, it's going to be impossible realistically to conduct a thorough investigation before a scheduled vote and this whole thing gets derailed. I mean, doesn't that seem like a more likely scenario?
It certainly seems like a possible scenario, and it does seem like it, based on the fact that they hid this from the chair of the committee, not even the rest of the Republicans, the chair of the committee should have been apprised of this situation so that they could address it in one-on-one meetings with Kavanaugh. They could address it during the hearing. They could address it during the follow-up questions. I mean, Democrats had I think they had 1,300 questions on that follow-up questionnaire after the hearing, never mentioned this at all. So, yeah, I mean, there's a charitable takeaway from this, but your scenario is at least as likely to be true.
Well, I mean, and again, there could be a myriad of scenarios. We don't know. This is what's so hard about this.
By midweek, it seemed uncertain whether Dr. Ford would appear at best. My show prep brought to mind another person whose opinion in this matter was valuable, Congresswoman Martha McSally of Arizona, a retired Air Force colonel elected to Congress in 2014 and the Republican nominee for the Senate seat being vacated by Jeff Flake. She has a unique perspective on these issues. Dr. Ford deserves every opportunity to tell her story. You are yourself a survivor of sexual abuse. Am I correct about that?
I am, yes.
And if she doesn't appear, I don't know that it would change a single vote. What's your comment?
Well, and I do agree. I mean, the allegations are serious, and she does have the right to be heard. And Brett Kavanaugh has the right to also be heard. All of this, I think, needs to be weighed against the massive amounts of testimonies and background checks and experience of the candidates. Again, having been through this, I certainly don't have a PhD in it, but I will tell you also, having been in the military and my own experiences as a commander and a leader there, dirtbags are usually pattern dirtbags. You know, they usually, you know, these types of things happen over and over and over again until somebody gets caught. And so this just seems to be a partial memory of something 36 years ago that wasn't told to anyone at the time. Again, I think she's sincere in her beliefs of what happened to her, and she should be able to tell her story, and that needs to then be weighed against, you know, Judge Kavanaugh's response and the other weight of the evidence while we move forward to fill this important position with the Supreme Court session starting in early October.
I love your statement. Dirt bags are usually pattern dirt bags, and there is no such pattern with Judge Kavanaugh, correct?
Exactly. That's the point. You look at the number of women from his life and that time in high school and the character of him in all of his years since then. Everything he has been through and background checks and the way he has carried himself as an individual and a judge and a man and a father, again, doesn't fit the pattern.
So we will look for that on Monday. Let me move to a separate subject, one very near and dear to my heart. Kristen Sinema, when she was an anti-war activist, her group circulated a flyer which is deeply offensive to every member in the military, but especially to families of members in the military. This is what really gets me. The idea that our sons and daughters are killers and terrorists, and Kristen Sinema was circulating this. What sort of an issue has this become? Because it ought to be the issue, what she believed about our troops in during war.
Well, absolutely, Hugh. I mean, look, and this was broke by CNN, you know, hardly a conservative outlet. We had already framed this race because we knew Sinema was a radical left activist and protester. Well, I was overseas right after 9/11. She's protesting our troops. She's protesting in a pink tutu. She's protesting, you know, many different times. And in this case, the protest she was leading, they had flyers put out. You can check the CNN article that depicted a U.S. soldier as a skeleton and said, you know, stop the U.S. terror in the Middle East. This is disqualifying for a Senate candidate, from our view, across the country, but especially in Arizona. We are pro-military, pro-veteran, patriotic, and we want to make sure that our senators care and respect about our troops. And this is unbelievable. The fact that no one in the Arizona media is even paying any attention to it is ridiculous, but this just shows her true colors. She's a protester. I'm a patriot. I put my life on the line for her freedom to be able to protest. So, you know, if you want to do that, God bless you. But that doesn't make you, you know, the right person to be the next senator from Arizona. So I hope people check this out. And I hope the Arizona media starts taking this seriously. Again, it was broke by CNN. And this is a major development. They sort of dismissed our pink tutu, you know, her in a pink tutu and me in a flight suit as our opening contrast in this race. And a long time ago. Like, BS. You know, this shows the character of the woman who wants to be the 12th senator from Arizona, and she needs to be rejected.
No, this is only 15 years ago. And again, families of people in the military have got to focus on what Kristen Sinema thought of their sons and daughters, not just people who serve. They're used to, I mean, having it roll off their back. They may not like it, but I've never heard a uniformed member of the service object to protesters. Never. Not once in since the war began. But I do know families, and I know that we are mad about this. And I cannot believe that the Arizona Republic has not got this on the front page, because she can't say that's not me. That's her.
Right. And she led this protest. So these were the signs that were for this protest. Her email address was the reply to her for come out for the sign making party and come to the protest. So she owns this thing. And again, you're right. Families and members of the military should be disgusted. And those who were not served in the military, any American should be disgusted that this woman is so ambitious that she's reinvented herself, tried to cover her tracks, and she's actually running, pretending, you know, that she's got this record on pro-military and pro-veterans. She wanted to slash our military. She wanted to shut down Luke Air Force Base. She's an extreme radical left. But we are neck and neck, Hugh. People are voting in 21 days, early voting, 48 days to Election Day. We're down to the wire here, and the balance of the Senate goes through Arizona.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
What if the homeless person puts his tent on public property in the local park where you like to take your children to use the playground?
Homelessness advocates are making great progress in the Northwest when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Advocacy for homelessness seems to know no bounds. Cities across the West, from Honolulu to Seattle and south to Los Angeles and San Diego, are working hard to solve homelessness, but with varying degrees of success. San Francisco has to be the poster city for making accommodations to the homeless, often at the expense of their citizens and at the loss of tourism dollars. It is evident the problem has now moved east to other blue states like Chicago and Detroit. Here's my Salem colleague, Michael Medved, up in the Pacific Northwest, who has observed rampant homelessness in nearby Seattle, commenting on an op-ed in the Seattle Times.
I don't want to give this a Golden Turkey Award, though my impulse was to give it a Golden Turkey Award. The reason I won't give it is because the photograph of the contributor makes him look so painfully sincere. I mean, like a nice guy who really means well. And his name is Bill Block. He's the former director of the Committee to End Homelessness in King County. Well, that's going well.
I mean, the committee then, I don't understand why he's the former director. Yeah, but the one thing about the committee to end homelessness, I would imagine that you have a very secure future if your job is working for the committee to end homelessness, because nothing is going to end homelessness, not in King County, not anywhere. He writes under the headline, House and Help, Don't Criminalize the Homeless. He writes about what he sees a very negative trend. With a growing number of jurisdictions, he writes, even those who are also building housing are responding to the homeless crisis by treating people experiencing homelessness as less worthy of respect and protection than those of us fortunate enough to have escaped the medical crisis, loss of work, or severe depression that forced our neighbor into homelessness. And by the way, it's just stunning that the official government estimate is now 554,000 people are currently experiencing homelessness in this country. That, of course, includes people who are living in homeless shelters, people who are living in homeless encampments, people who are living in their cars, people who lack conventional housing. And the idea that you might treat someone who is pitching a tent illegally in a city park or in his sleeping bag and throwing trash everywhere under a freeway overpass, you might treat someone like that with a little bit less respect than, oh, I don't know, than you'd treat a preschool teacher or you'd treat a police officer. I think that's appropriate. Is it not appropriate to treat people with different levels of respect based upon their behavior? He writes, cities across Washington have been criminalizing people asking for donations. They're not asking for donations. This is not a legitimate nonprofit. They're not asking for donations. What kind of language is this? They're asking for handouts. Again, if you all of a sudden are holding up a sign that says donation requested, well, what's the recognized charity here? And what actually are you donating to provide? He then says governmental agencies have invaded people's encampments. What do you mean people's encampments? Often taking and destroying key parts of the residents' lives. How absurd is that? What if the homeless person puts his tent on public property? And in the local park where you like to take your children to use the playground? Because that's the reality. Is this individual saying that there's nothing that you can do to protect your children from discarded needles and garbage and filth in public parks that we all pay for? As extreme as the homeless situation has gotten, and this is what troubles me about this contribution by Bill Block, House and Help, Don't Criminalize the Homeless. At no point does he recognize that there is a great majority, and it's out there, and it's Republicans and Democrats, and it's liberals and conservatives and moderates, who are just sick of it and really need action. And no, the action is not investing more billions and billions and billions in public housing, because what we're talking about is people who often turn down the offer of shelter beds and housing. He then says, harassing people who have had the misfortune to become homeless, destroying their possessions and arresting them for being on the streets when they have no other option are ineffective ways to deal with their problems and in the long run much more expensive than housing and services. Equally important such actions are, as the Boise case reminds us, a violation of the basic rights that each of us holds dear. Ignoring the rights of people experiencing homelessness creates a class of others that is toxic to the very fabric of our society. You know what's toxic to the very fabric of our society? The idea that the public has no right to clear away this mess.
Well, there are plenty of domestic and political problems in our nation. We do well to remind ourselves of our great blessings that still abound. Going back as far as November 2016, economic prosperity has been growing, the likes of which has not been seen for more than 10 years. One particularly refreshing point has been job growth among the, quote, underclass. Minority communities that often lag behind employment numbers for the nation at large. Mike Gallagher verified this when he caught up with Alfredo Ortiz, president of the Job Creators Network.
With everything in turmoil and all the chaos, one thing that is very clear, jobs numbers, job creation is profound. Alfredo Ortiz knows a thing or two about creating jobs.
He was vice president of CSM Bakery Products Food Service Division. It was a $2 billion global food company. He's testified before legislative committees about the impact of bad government policy on job creation. He, of course, is the president and CEO of the Job Creators Network, one of our great partners here at the Mike Gallagher Show. And what a joy it is to welcome him back to the show on a day like today. Alfredo, the median household income for Hispanic households hit $50,486 in 2017. That's another record. We continue to, earlier this week, middle-class families, record high median income. Alfredo, it's like we just can't get out of the way of this great economy right now, or can we?
You know, Mike, if only I had known earlier that Armageddon fell like this, I would have been trying to do this a lot earlier.
No kidding. No kidding. I mean, there's such great news.
In addition to some of the numbers we just are seeing today, you know, when you look at Hispanic unemployment, it continues to remain at record lows. And in fact, Hispanics are just continuing opening up small businesses, which we know is the engine of our economy. They hire people in local communities. And when you actually even look in terms of surveys, what Hispanics are feeling about the Trump administration and the tax cuts, they are loving this. And I'm so excited to see this because it's a great opportunity for Hispanics to really have a piece of the pie, a piece of that American dream.
Right. And Americans, we're 49 days away from the midterm election. Alfredo, I hate to go political on you, but heaven forbid the Democrats have promised to take those tax cuts away. We're going to be in for a world of hurt if there is the supposed blue wave on November the 6th.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we are actually just starting this week our third phase of tax cuts work, Mike, which is crazy. 50 stops in 25 states.
Wow.
This week we're going to St. Louis, Missouri, Franklin, Tennessee, Lexington, Kentucky, Turlock, California. You know, what we're hearing from small business owners across the country, at every single one of the stops, their optimism is sky high. And they are deadly afraid of a takeover of the House by the Democrats because the fact that Warren and Schumer and Pelosi, I mean, all these characters have really basically point blank promised that tax cuts would be repealed if they took over.
And Alfredo, that's not a scare tactic on your part. That's not hyperbole. They are on record as saying that's what they want to do. What happens if these tax cuts are repealed?
Well, and that's the thing. All of this optimism, all of this great energy, the 4.2% GDP growth, record low unemployment with Hispanics, Asians, Blacks, women, all of this growth of small businesses investing back, all of this, frankly, is all on the line. If they do take this back, they have promised to repeal the tax cuts, point blank.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
If you're looking for what's this book about, it's about mismanaging the presidency.
Bob Woodward, when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Watergate scandal of the early 70s roughed up a lot of people, including many who served in the Nixon administration. Bob Woodward, then a junior reporter at the Washington Post, was teamed with Carl Bernstein to investigate a burglary at the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate complex. Their investigative journalism led to the Post's outing of the dirty tricks crimes by Nixon operatives, the scandal which led to President Nixon's resignation. Woodward and Bernstein then co-wrote All the President's Men about Watergate, which brought with it fame, access, and a fabulous book writing future, especially for Woodward. Mr. Woodward recently published his latest presidential book, Fear, on the Trump administration. Bob Woodward was a guest on my program.
I believe if the president had actually read this book and their team had read this book, they would not have attacked the book. They would have spun it differently because there's a lot complimentary in this book. The most important of which is John Dowd firmly believes, the president's former lawyer, that the special counsel, Bob Mueller, has nothing. There's no collusion. It's all play to get to an 18 U.S.C. 1001 perjury trap, and that POTUS should never sit down. Is that a fair assessment of what John Dowd believes?
Well, until the end. And finally, at the point where Dowd resigns because he is convinced the president should not testify, Dowd concludes that Mueller had played him for a sucker, got all of the cooperation of 37 witnesses, a million pages plus of campaign documents, 20,000 pages of White House documents. So in the end, is he says to the president, he said, you were right. We can't trust Mueller.
And I tell you, Bob Woodward, I read this book as a lawyer. I'm not a defense lawyer, although I was a justice. Dowd got played badly. Do you agree?
Well, but he is the one who decided on the strategy. Total cooperation. We're going to let you. We're opening the door completely. I mean, some of the most sensitive material was given to Mueller. He was delighted to have it. It is quite true that Dowd concluded from his own work. Remember, he spent eight months on this intensely, time with Mueller, time with the White House people, time with Trump, and he didn't see anything there until the end.
So much has not been reported about fear. I want to tell you the most surprising thing. Page 132, quote, Russia had privately warned Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, that if there was a war in the Baltics, Russia would not hesitate to use tactical nuclear weapons against NATO. All right, Bob Woodward, that's a headline. Has anyone picked up on that?
They have not. Very, very significant. And it's part of the argument that President Trump and Dowd make, namely that this investigation, the Mueller investigation, is tying the president's hands in being president. And he cites some examples, and that's one of them. And, of course, that's pretty frightening.
It is. Russia has never before threatened to use tactical nuclear weapons against NATO since Russia became Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that's news breaking. Some of the best reporting in the book is about O Plan 5027. This is the plan for the preemptive strike on North Korea put together for President Obama that he reviewed. And the 2017 drills exercising were not secure. Civilian picked up the chatter on the low-level bombing runs. I was stunned by that.
Yes. I mean, this is, you know, they were really working options. And as you well know, that's the job of the Pentagon, of the intelligence people, and ultimately of the president.
Page 98, a source tells you that President Obama and his team, they've been hiding the problem. That's a quote about North Korea. They've been hiding the problem from the American people. Pretty devastating assessment. How good is that source?
Couldn't be better. And they did. But at the end, as we know now publicly, President Obama said to President Trump, it's North Korea that will keep you up at night.
And but they'd been hiding that from us. It's great reporting. Now, your assessment, your analysis on page 236, you start at 100 points with President Trump. The closer you are, the further away you get. I think that's very astute, Bob Woodward, that you kind of run through your credit with him. And then you're depleted. And like Rex Tillerson or Reince Priebus, you go, even though Reince is still close to him and talks to him a lot.
Yes, exactly. And he uses people. Now, look, all presidents use people, but there is a kind of insulting tone often. I mean, it's not just a tone. He insults people. And I think if you're looking for what's this book about, it's about mismanaging the presidency. That so often I was struck by just the simple fact that Trump would do things that are not in his own interest. If he would just have advisors or listen and count to 10. So what is one of the realities of the Trump presidency? There is a war on truth.
For my complete interview with Bob Woodward, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
people have lost that sense of gratitude.
Erasing America, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADA, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The last 2 years, particularly since President Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton,
has seen an uptick in anger. The roots of this anger, which actually goes back to the mid-20th century, has often been accompanied by ridicule, even hatred of the foundation of our nations. Our educators have seen fit to modify reading lists, rewrite history to cover up certain history, books, leaders, and events. James Robbins, a journalist and senior fellow for the National Security Affairs at American Foreign Policy Council, is out with a new book, Erasing America, Losing Our Future by Destroying Our Past. Robbins was a guest of Michael Medved.
Let's make clear to people at the very outset that even though you touch on some of the controversy involving Confederate monuments, this is not a defense of the Confederacy. This is not some kind of revisionist history of the Civil War. This is really a book about whether all Americans in every region of the country should feel guilty and apologetic about our country. And you don't think that's a good idea?
Oh, no, I think that's a bad idea. And, you know, since we're making it clear, I'm a Yankee from Ohio. So, it's, you know, not like I was trying to defend the Confederacy. But the Confederate statues issue is really the entry point to this thing, since it's one of the most visible issues. But it's not just about that. It's about the attacks on the founding fathers, the attacks on presidents like Andrew Jackson or Abe Lincoln. It's the attack on the Constitution, on the flag, on the national anthem. It's all those things.
In fact, there are virtually no figures who might be described as, you'll pardon the expression, white males in American history who are exempt from attack. They are trying to get rid of the statue of Theodore Roosevelt, who was in so many ways progressive. They're trying to get rid of Theodore Roosevelt in front of the New York Museum of Natural History, which, by the way, his father founded. So what's the deal? What is the basis for trying to get rid of Roosevelt?
Oh, well, the statue in question shows him on a horse, and on one side is a Native American, on the other side is an African tribesman. So it was representative of colonialism and the genocide of Native Americans. So
one of the things that I was reminded of in your book, the book is called Erasing America. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com, is just the range and the depth of stupidity here. For instance, the idea that To Kill a Mockingbird has to be stricken from schools when it has a whole message against segregation and racism. What's the problem with To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, yes, because of the language in it. And I found that to be particularly ironic, since I'm sure when we were growing up, To Kill a Mockingbird was part of the civil rights canon. I mean, it was something that was written to show what the problem was. So now they say, well, you can't use the language that's in To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, because it's offensive. But the point of it is to point that out. So, I mean, this is kind of ridiculous.
And I think about John C. Calhoun. I went to Yale, and I'm very familiar with Calhoun College. But given the fact that John C. Calhoun was not only a slave owner, but he was a very, very enthusiastic promulgator of the idea that slavery was better than free market economics. He suggested that slaves were better treated than workers in the North, and basically that the Southern system of slavery was the ideal system of labor that had ever been adopted. Can you allow that it's not out of bounds for people to question naming one of Yale's 12 residential colleges after John C. Calhoun?
Oh, no, it's not out of bounds. In fact, Yale undertook a very methodical survey of this question. They had a panel that came up with the principal legacy standard, which I think is a very good standard, where you look at a figure in history and say, what did they do that has had an enduring impact on the society? Or what is their most important thing that they did that we still are affected by today? And with Calhoun, they concluded that, well, there's really nothing in his principal legacy, even though John Kennedy said he was one of the five greatest senators in American history and put him in Profiles in Courage. But that aside, they say, OK, it's, you know, there's not enough there to overcome all of the negatives of his legacy, so we'll rename the school. I think that's a very valid way to approach this, certainly more valid than saying, you know, we're just going to tear down statues willy-nilly based on a single factor.
A lot of folks are talking about us being on the verge of a second civil war. You make the case at the end of your book that that's a bad idea. Why?
Well, yes, very bad idea. The first civil war, the only one so far, was the largest war of the 19th century. There were more people killed in that than all our other wars combined. And it was just simply devastating. And I can see that in a new war, particularly given the number of guns in this country and just the laydown of it, which I try to do a strategic laydown, you just have mass chaos. It would be extremely destructive. Many people would die. If our social infrastructure collapsed or physical infrastructure collapsed, I mean, just imagine what would happen in the cities and then flooding into the countryside. Plus, there's the possibility that a foreign power could intervene, perhaps with nuclear weapons. I mean, just when you think about it, this is a very, very bad idea.
It is. And again, I think you one of the points you make is that none of the issues that we're confronting right now, other than love of America itself, would rise to the importance that people would actually be battling over them. What is it that people get most wrong about the United States that undermines their proper gratitude for this great country?
I think that people, they just have lost that sense of gratitude. They've been so focused on sort of negative revisionist aspects of our history, they lose sight of all of the wonderful things, all of the great things. This is why in the book I suggest that people look at their own family histories, how people came here, what they did when they got here, you know, the land of opportunity, the American dream, whether they came, you know, in one generation or 400 years ago, or, you know, even Native Americans, even people whose ancestors were brought over as slaves. But to look at all of the great things this country has done for people, and of course it's not perfect.
Listen to Michael's entire interview with Dr. Robbins at townhallreview.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up,
Google's co-founder.
People here are pretty upset and pretty sad for because of the election. But there's another group very excited about the legalization of pot.
Larry Elder, when the final segment of the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Google, the mega tech company that controls a great deal of the world's internet search and internet ad dollars, has their own unique and no surprise left of center corporate culture. Recently, a video of one of their corporate family gatherings was leaked to Breitbart.com. Here's my colleague, Larry Elder.
Somebody has leaked to Breitbart a video of a meeting that was described as an all-hands meeting shortly after the 2016 election. Check this out.
Okay, folks, I know this is probably not the most joyous TGIF we have had.
First speaker is Google's co-founder. Again, this is Google. This is a search engine that we all use.
Let's face it, most people here are pretty upset and pretty sad for because of the election. But there's another group, a small group that we should also think about, who are very excited about the legalization of pot.
In this one, we're talking about the reaction to the election, and we're also going to be talking about what they think about Trump supporters.
And the forces out there are seem well beyond you. Globalization, immigration, trade, whatever else. And you're afraid and you're trying to look for answers. And that fear, I think, not just in the United States, but around the world, is what's fueling concerns, xenophobia, hatred, and a desire for answers that may or may not be there. It's feeling a distrust of experts and disregard of traditional institutions. And we're trying to figure out, how do we respond to that? What are the next steps for us before the world comes into this environment of tribalism that's self-destructive on the long
term? Tribalism.
Long term.
Self-destructive.
There are cycles of these things that often can last 5, 10 years before people feel as though, you know, that they've had a chance to vent that anger. And yet, we do think that history is on our side in a profound and an important way. That Martin Luther King made famous a line that the moral arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. I would say that the moral arc of history is long, but it bends toward progress. And out of progress comes rising living standards and better health care, and ultimately the ability to transcend those forces of tribalism and, yes, reach toward justice.
Unbelievable. That's the senior VP for global affairs. His name is Kent Walker. A fear not just in the United States, but around the world, is fueling concern, xenophobia, hatred, a desire for answers that may or may not be there. Tribalism, self-destructive. Can you imagine what's going to happen in the event that the Democrats do not take over the House? My goodness.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.